Advanced Bird Language, Beating the Concentric Rings of Nature, with John Young.
Okay, a few details that don't really fit anywhere else. I'll kind of put them in here now before I get to my favorite part of this whole talk. First thing I want to remind everybody is this is a journey of quality and not quantity. And I've heard that over and over 1,000 times, that it doesn't matter if you've hiked in the wilderness for 100 years. It's not the quantity of time that you spend there, but it's the quality of your awareness with every step that you take that makes the difference between whether you succeed on this journey or not. Success is going to be relative. Remember also that birds are like watchtowers. They're like fire towers in a way. We can't really see what they see. So sometimes we assume that they're making sounds and it's a random thing. But remember, because they're up 10 feet higher than us, they can see a whole lot more than we can. Just if you want to remind yourself of this, climb 10 feet into a tree and see what happens to your perspective. They're able to see things at a greater distance than we can see. They're able to detect things we can't detect. they also have different hearing ability than we do, and that was well illustrated for me one day when I did something that I'm going to suggest to all of you too, some ways to work your backyard a little bit more effectively or to work with the local park. Because I was lying down on the ground within 20 feet of a bird feeder out in Duval, Washington, out in the rural countryside. And I was waiting for all the birds to come back in because I kind of spooked them out of there by going out and lying down on the ground 20 feet from the bird feeder. Kind of got myself mixed in with the salmon berries along the edge of a hill. I wasn't really too camouflaged, and I kind of let people know too that I don't necessarily believe in camouflage per se, you know, going and getting military camouflage or any special patterns that you buy from these camouflage outfits as necessarily being any more effective than the color black or the color brown or the color dark green. So I'm a great believer in what I call earth tones, just dark colors that are light absorbent and a fluffy nap, you know, that doesn't reflect light, but that absorbs light. I think the best out there, apparently, is King of the Mountain stuff, which is really ultraviolet tested so that it doesn't even give off light the way it's designed. It's very expensive, but it's supposed to be the best. But remember, the scouts didn't have any of that stuff. You know, these great invisibility masters and ninjas, the same thing. They just used dark colors, darkly smoked brain tan buckskins. You know, that was plenty effective. So when you're thinking about camouflage, you know, I feel that it's more of a state of mind and the way that you approach it than anything else. It's what you know about the forest that comes into play here. It's not so much, you know, the pattern or the expense of your camouflage that makes the difference here. To me, it's all about your knowledge, your awareness. So I was lying down at the edge of a shadowy place, kind of randomly, just comfortable too. I mean, I was tired from writing and I just wanted to take a break, and I'm lying down there waiting for the birds to come back to the feeder, and I was kind of noting what is the hierarchy, the progression of birds returning in the Pacific Northwest, because I knew it back where I was from, and I was curious, who's going to come back first? Who's the bravest in this backyard here? Who's going to come back first? So I learned a lot that day. I learned that jays, Steller's jays, made these really funny calls and imitated hawks, and when they were successful at it, they could scatter all the birds off the feeder and then get to take over. They were pretty neat to watch. But I also learned on that day something about towhees that really kind of startled me. I noticed that the second to the last bird that returned to the feeder, there was chickadees visiting, there was varied thrushes cruising around again, and they were feeding and they were happy. They weren't coming to the feeder, but they were back into baseline pretty quick. And everything seemed to be kind of mellow, and the song sparrows were the second to last to appear on the scene, and they came from the salmonberry hedge that behind it dropped down off a hill. They came out onto the lawn. And after the song sparrows had been comfortably feeding for about two, 3 minutes. It was then that the TOWIES made their appearance. And I thought, well, is this a coincidence, you know? But I watched it over and over, day after day, and it was always that way. The TOWIES were the last to arrive. So they had the greatest cougar medicine, maybe you could say. They were the most cautious. When the TOWIES came out, they would feed rhythmically, constantly watching each other. They always arranged their body so that they could use their peripheral vision to see their mate, because they really took cues off of each other's body language, and I was really observing how they were doing that. they're feeding in that rhythmic style that they have. And as they were feeding, all of a sudden I noticed at one point they both stopped feeding simultaneously. They got still, and then they just kind of nonchalantly moved off into the brush. They made no noise. They didn't make a big deal out of it. But I noticed that when the TOWIES slipped off into the brush, it was about a minute later that the song sparrows noticed that the TOWIES were gone, and the song sparrows got nervous. They looked at each other. They made a soft call. I'm not going to say it was an alarm call, because it didn't sound alarming to me. It was just sort of, hey, notice the TOWIES are gone. Oh, yeah, they slipped into the shadows also. They took a cue off the TOWIES. At that point, the other birds were busy feeding. You know, it was kind of like adolescent self-absorbed behavior. All the other birds were kind of blackbirds, the red wings and whatnot, were just kind of making a lot of noise and feeding around, and chickadees were coming and going still. And it was just then that I heard an alarm, you know, and the alarm was kind of intense, and all these birds kind of scattered up off the feeder. 15 seconds later, Barney the Beagle appeared. You know, he was coming. Now, the TOWIES somehow, and I have to say it was either instinct or subsonic sound, the TOWIES knew that Barney was coming long before anyone else did. And the song sparrows may not have known Barney was coming, but they took a cue off the TOWIES' behavior, you know. So I'm just saying to you that the backyard is an awesome place to learn this stuff. I mean, it's so cool. If you have 15 minutes and you're too tired to do anything, you don't feel like doing anything, instead of sitting on the couch and, you know, flipping through the channels mindlessly, why not go lie down next to a bird feeder in your backyard, you know, and veg out there instead for 15 minutes? You know, or if it's too cold or wet outside to do that, just go to your window and do that. Set up bird feeding stations around your yard. The Audubon Society and National Wildlife Federation, you know, get involved with those programs. And there's a great magazine called Birds and Blooms that talks about enhancing your backyard for bird habitat and wildlife habitat. There's a lot of local places that you can find. There's even stores showing up in malls now, Wild Bird Centers of America, that teach you all about how to set up your yard as a more diverse place so you can enhance your yard and create an awesome backyard secret spot. You know, put a bird feeders, several different kinds of feeders, and we compost outdoors too, and I love what the compost pile teaches me also. That's a great teacher, as well as a bird bath if you don't have water around you. You know, just to put like a bird bath out or a little pond, you know, just create a little pond. These are all things that can help you learn this faster. Greg Sommer reminded me today that out at his secret spot out in the rural foothills of Duval, up against the forestry land, which extends all the way to Canada and Mexico through the national forest system and the ridges and the mountains and the national parks. I mean, he's on the edge of a huge wilderness. You know, he's got what you might think is the ideal secret spot. But as he points out to me, I can't really learn anything about bird language and human interaction because there's no humans at my secret spot. So I'm learning a lot about other stuff out there, but I'm not really learning about humans. So what do? I go down to, what's the name of that park, Ravenna Park, or the parks in Seattle.
Yeah, West Seattle a lot, because tons of fox over there.
Okay, so he goes out to West Seattle, which is, you know, almost urban, you know, somewhat suburban, but there's some red foxes out there, and he goes out, and that's where he learns his bird alarm behavior from the people. So, you know, going to local parks will teach you about people. So don't turn up your nose. You know, I remember in the beginning thinking about how frustrated people get. I can't learn this because I live in the city, or I can't learn this because I don't have time to get into the woods. You know, the woods has its limits, you know, in terms of what it's going to teach you. So remember, if you want to learn about people alarms, you have to go where people are. You know, that's important to remember. So Greg was also reflecting on something. I'm just going to let you know that I've been mentoring Greg since 1994 in the autumn, and it's 1999 in the summer. So he's been an apprentice of mine in this for a long time. He's got a huge amount of dirt time out there, and sang for the last 20 to 30 times he's at a secret spot, he's noticed the song sparrows doing something really peculiar. They seem to be moving at the same height along the salmonberry hedge, alarming as they're approaching him after he's been sitting at his spot for a while, and he's thinking, oh, here comes a cat, you know, by the behavior. And then that song sparrow goes across a clearing giving the alarm, and there's no cat under it. And then it continues on the other side, so there's even either an invisible cat passing along, or Greg is saying to me, you know, what's causing that? That's happened now so many times, you know, I've seen it over and over again. What is this? You know, so I'm going to just sort of use this moment to show you what, you know, Tom always did to me. Basically, Greg, I'm going to just ask you, from looking at that, why don't you go ask the sparrows? You know, you have enough experience now where if you put your mind, and Jen, the same thing for your chicory, go ask the chicory directly, what are you telling me? What is this teaching me? You know, because you get to a certain point where you've seen things at your secret spot. Now you've been there for 5 years, probably both of you for 5 years. You're at the point now where you have to answer your own questions, you know, and you just have to dig in deeply and just ask the animals directly. And in time, the answer will come. It doesn't always come when you want it. It's not like, okay, song sparrow, what does this mean? You know, grab the little sucker and choke him. Tell me what this means. Right? He's not going to answer you in that moment. But what usually happens, and what's always happened for me, is that I've asked a question, journaled about it. As Tom says, research it until you're exhausted. Research all of your physical ability to explain what's going on. And when you reach the end of your physical limits, your physical ability to research and get the answer, at that point, you got to turn to your instincts. You have to turn to the song sparrow itself and say, what are you telling me? And let it be. Release and walk away. And what will happen is, in a very surprising manner, synchronicity will enter in, and by some quirk or coincidence, the answer will come to you. Maybe someone will walk up to you randomly and tell you something that will remind you of this, and you'll say, oh my God, that's the answer. Maybe you'll be in a bookstore, and a book will catch your attention, and you'll grab it off the shelf, and you open it, and there will be your answer. You never know how the answer is going to come, but trust that the answer will come. You know, and that seems like a far-fetched thing to some of you out there listening, but this I know to be true from mentoring people and myself, from having had these very experiences. You know, I was I'm 28 years on this path as a scout, and it's been at least 20 of those 28 years that I've known this to be true. That when I've exhausted physical possibility and stretched my brain to its maximum to answer the question, that I can always turn to the unseen, the instinct within me, to answer that question, and the answer will always come to me. So, I look for a moment at a few other details. I was kind of hinting for a little while there to you all about the use of binoculars and using them at your secret spot. You know, is it a good idea? Is it not a good idea? I get asked that more times than I can tell. I highly recommend that if you want to bring binoculars with you, bring them. You know, use your binoculars until you feel like you don't want to use them anymore. I mean, it's simple as that. I learned a lot from binoculars. I wore out my binoculars. I mean, I beat those things to death learning my birds. And that's because I didn't have anyone to actually teach me the birds. You know, I was out at my secret spot alone. You know, and when I couldn't answer a question, when I came upon a bird that was making a sound or a song that I couldn't quite figure out, well, I used every resource possible. I listened to every tape, and I looked in those bird guides. And, you know, the bird guides people, remember, they're trying to do their best to put bird songs to words. You know, so if I see one, I would seize one and squeeze it till it squirts. That might not exactly sound like what you're hearing out there, but you have to use that information. And I like to tell people to cross-reference, you know, use the Peterson Field Guide to Birds, use the Zim Guide to Birds in North America. It has sonograms in it. That's like notes on a scale. It's like reading music. It helps you to see the pattern of the song. You know, use those bird tapes, use those CDs, but keep it simple. Don't scatter yourself all over creation. Just stay focused. Pick one bird to learn at a time. And now I'm saying you're now beyond learning the robin. You know, we talked about learn that robin in your backyard till you, you know, exhaust every piece of knowledge about it that you can find, right? Now I'm saying when you're out in the forest and you hear a new bird sound that you've never heard before, just focus on that bird. If that's what you want to learn, focus on that bird until you learn it. The Peterson Guide has in the front of it what used to be in a book all by itself, a book called How to Know the Birds by Roger Torrey Peterson. I still think that that's an awesome book. It's probably out of print, but you might be able to find it if you're a good sleuth, if you know how to use the resources out there for finding books out of print. That little paperback taught me more about how to identify birds than any single book. I think Tom gave it to me because he realized the importance of pattern recognition. It teaches you how to use habitats to figure out what birds are supposed to be there, how to look at tree height to figure out what birds are supposed to be there, how to look at birds at their what you would call their average body posture. You know, are they birds that sit upright? Are they birds that lean over? Are they birds that feed on the ground? Are they birds that hop continuously? Are they birds that run? You know, it's an excellent book that teaches you how to look at birds, and it will save you a lot of time. I think they sort of digested that information, condensed it, and put it in the front of the new editions of the Peterson Field Guides. But I still think that book stands alone because it does a really good job of sort of habitat analysis. That will really help you a lot. What Tom had me do in my days, I remember I was probably about 13 when I first started this, because my first entry into this journal system was in 1973. And what I was doing was, each time I saw a bird, Tom would ask me, what did I see when I was out at my secret spot today? What kind of bird? And I'd say, well, I saw a wood thrush today. I heard it singing and I saw it. He's like, what time did you see it? I don't know. He said, well, think back. What time are you there? And I said, well, it was I got home from school about 2:30. I've been there for about, maybe it was about 3:15. He's like, which way was the wind blowing when you saw that bird? And he would start asking me these kinds of questions. So pretty soon, he suggested to me that I start keeping track of what I'm seeing. So I created a file card system, you know, with the A to Z separators, the little tabs in a file card box, and I kept one index card in there for each bird that I would see. So if I saw a wood thrush, I would pull out my wood thrush card, and I would write down entry number 3, you know, the date, the time, the weather, what the bird was doing, where I saw it, you know, that sort of thing. And having to name where I saw all these birds, I was also beginning to, what we call in the IMSA Theory program of our school, songlining, you know, naming different parts of my landscape until I developed an internal mind map of my whole region. And that was done through the birds, by learning the birds in my area. Of course, some of those index cards filled up real quick because some birds I saw all the time. And after a while, I stopped looking at, well, I didn't stop looking at that bird, but I stopped journaling it because it became, I'm not going to say commonplace to the point where I ignored it, because I was taught never to ignore anything. But I would note its presence in my mind, and I would pay more attention to the ones that I didn't know. And by keeping track of the ones that I did know, it showed me which ones I didn't know. And through that process, I slowly but surely learned every bird song, every call, every possibility in my bioregion. And there, as I say to people, when by the time I was 15 or 16, I knew a bird by its fart, you know, quite literally. It was at that stage where I knew every bird and every behavior, not because I was life listing, but because I was using what we call Kim's game, looking at something and then trying to remember every detail of it afterwards, because Tom was constantly prompting me to answer every question I could answer about not just the bird, what's it doing, what kind of tree was it in, what's the weather like, what was the wind doing? You know, have you seen that pattern before? Always quizzing me and pulling me deeper and deeper into the behavior and the setting that the bird was in. So that's how I learned it. There's some neat things that you come upon that one of my senior instructors, Dan Gardoki, who I've been mentoring since about 1985, what he suggested to me to make sure that you guys heard from me was, you know, that there's a lot of neat little things that you can gather from being out there a lot. For instance, there's what he calls the pre-sounds that, you know, you're going to pick up on, like the sounds that a whippoorwill makes before it starts singing or right after it's done singing that the tape doesn't quite get out to you. You know, you start to hear little sounds that are made before the birds start singing. These are really interesting things that you come upon that you won't find in the field guides. Also non-vocal sounds, you know, such sounds that are made by ruffed grouse when they've thump their wings against their sides when they're doing their territorial call, or woodpeckers beating on the trees with their beaks to make a sound, or the sounds of a mourning dove as it flies over its flight quills, making the sounds that they make, or the sounds of a goose's wing as it squeaks as they fly overhead, learning to recognize all these different kinds of non-vocal sounds that are made by birds, learning to recognize the patterns of a feeding white-throated sparrow versus the patterns of a feeding towhee. The difference in volume and intensity of those sounds sort of tells you that the towhee is heavier than the sparrow. You can actually hear that. You're like tracking the sounds of these birds, knowing the sound of a squirrel running through the forest versus the sound of a chipmunk, versus the sound of a walking deer, versus the sound of a walking human. Training your ears to recognize non-vocal sounds is really important too. And Dan suggests to all of you not to get hung up on field guide terminology, but to really just remember what I'm saying here. This is about getting to know your neighbors in an enjoyable fashion. You don't have to get hung up on the ornithology or the intensity of the terminology. Just get to know the birds. Have fun with it. And the basic bird ID tips, as I said to you before, you're going to gather them from the front of the Peterson Field Guide. But as I'm going to recommend to you, as will a lot of people, you should really get involved with your local Audubon Society. You'll be mentored very quickly in how to identify and learn a lot about birds. And it's excellent, the number of people who are committed to bird watching out there in general. There's just, I believe I've heard it's the number one spectator sport. So that's kind of neat. That means in every neighborhood there's bird watchers. And that's a great bunch of people to get to know. They know a lot. They have all kinds of interesting resources. They know all these neat little spots that nobody else knows, you know, these little secret forests and little creek beds and little special areas that they all kind of share among themselves. And, you know, from that you can gain a lot of wisdom from these people who've been bird watching in your area for a long time. Okay, so those are the miscellaneous tips that I had for you. And now I'm going to launch into something that goes beyond learning birds at the bus stop. One of the measurements that I like to use is for a person's awareness is if they've been going to the bus stop for the last 12 years of their school career and they don't know the sounds and sights and calls of every bird that they've encountered on their journey to the bus stop. They haven't really been at the bus stop at all, have they? You know, those birds have been there every day. Those songs have been around them. I'm amazed at the number of people who aren't able to identify things that they've seen at their bus stop or actually didn't see at their bus stop every day of their life. So think about that when you're out there. You know, if I live in this place, I should know all the birds around my house. I think about my Aunt Carrie, who I referred to in the very beginning of this tape, one of the first things I mentioned. She was Carrie Rozek, who was born in Poland and moved to America. She was a devout Christian Catholic who learned a form of Catholicism that I never learned. She learned it in Poland, and she brought it over here. She was a devout practitioner of meditation through the rosary beads, you know, so she practiced the sacred silence. And she also was very insistent to me that the birds could talk. Not only did she tell me about Grandma Novak and the robin that touched its beak to her fingertip, but she was always telling me, since the youngest age I can remember, that the birds brought messages to her on a regular basis. And of course, that's what earned her reputation and her family, you know, as the aunt that was sort of different, shall we say. However, I will make a point that even though people talked about her in that way and kind of rolled their eyes when Aunt Carrie was around, they were the first ones to pick up the phone and call her whenever they were going to the horse races to find out what numbers they should bet. So, and their odds were always better at winning because Aunt Carrie helped them, I'll tell you that right now. So I think about Aunt Carrie. She always, you know, she brought to my attention since the youngest age I can remember that these were house sparrows that would come to her windowsill every single day. She'd feed them scraps of bread and birdseed. They would come to her windowsill every single day, and she would tell me that they were talking to her. "Carrie, Carrie," they would say, you know, "feed me, I'm hungry," you know, and she got that into my mind at a very young age that the birds were actually speaking to her. So I began to look at that, and I began to believe it. And, you know, because when you're a little kid, you don't discern, you know, if Aunt Carrie says the birds speak, well, they must speak. So I think I had a lot of belief in that from a young age, and I think that's going to be necessary for all of you to just trust and know that the birds are speaking, even if you don't quite know what it means yet. And that would be the beginning of it. But I'm going to say to you that Aunt Carrie had this unusual ability to dream about ancestors that had passed before in the family line, who would bring her messages that all of us needed to know in order to stay healthy and happy in our lives. And I'm not going to go into detail. I'll just tell you one story that she dreamed that Uncle Ray had come to her, which was her brother-in-law when he was alive. He came to Aunt Carrie in a dream and said, Aunt Carrie, we didn't call you, he said, Carrie, have the bar checked. There's something bad happening in the bar. The beams are going to give way. And so Aunt Carrie said to him, well, why don't you tell your wife, Josie, which is Carrie's sister, you know, Ray, why are you telling me? Tell Josie. That's what she said in the dream. And he said, Josie never listens to me anyway. I'm telling you, Carrie, because Josie will listen to you. You're her older sister. So again, Carrie woke up from that dream. She remembered it, and she decided to call Josie and tell her. Now, they, from the old country, take these things seriously. You know, that's why I say they form practice a form of Catholicism that I don't recognize in modern suburban experience. They believe a lot more in deep mind experience, dreams and visions and things like that. They're much more tuned into the mystical aspects of their religious practice. And Aunt Carrie called Josie. Josie kind of was ready to gaff it off, but heard the insistence in Aunt Carrie's voice, thought about it, and called an engineer in to inspect. And they had these beams in the Berkeley Bar, which is now a place called Bum Rogers in Seaside Park. But that place, there was they had veneer over the beams, you know, like fake beams over the real beams that were better looking than the beams were. And when the engineer came in, the inspector, and lifted down the veneer, it was filled with sawdust, and the entire beams, all of them, had been almost completely eaten through by termites. And he said that, and then if we had another northeast storm like the ones that hit the Jersey Shore, that bar would have certainly collapsed, and there was apartments upstairs that would have fallen into the bar below. So these are examples of, you know, I can't say with 100% certainty that Aunt Carrie's listening to birds triggers this kind of dreaming, but I'll tell you right now that it all adds up. And why does it add up, you know? And how can I say this boldly? You know, because I can sit here and look you in the eye and tell you that this is true, because I've observed it. And the reason I know this is not because Aunt Carrie caused me to be able to dream these things too, because I developed the same dreaming ability when I was in my early 20s that Aunt Carrie had. And I still have these kinds of dreams that tell me things. What's going on with that? It's not because of Aunt Carrie passing this on to me, but it's because I have mentored many people over the years since 1983. I've mentored over 200 trackers, and I can tell you now that it's those trackers, that subset of people that I've mentored, the ones who have taken the bird language seriously. It's the ones who have taken bird language seriously who all develop these, what we would call, seeing abilities. The ability to be a seer or to see beyond the obvious, beyond the physical. Tom Brown makes the same connection, and he talks about that I had, when I was 18 years old, I asked him, Tom, I'm really curious about these medicine people that I keep reading about and hearing about through your stories. I'm curious about Stalking Wolf. What's the recipe to create a medicine person? And he startled me by telling me to practice my skills. I thought he meant practicing my bow drill, fire making skills. And he said, yes, but no. He says, no, what you really need to practice is owl vision and fox walking. Well, he called it in those days splatter vision. I call wide angle. He calls it wide angle vision today, or we call it owl vision in our school because I like people to think about imitating an owl. It uses more of the brain when you're pretending you're an owl than if you're just thinking about wide angle vision. I said, how could that be? You know, how could fox walking and owl vision trigger this? But in those days, he was very hesitant to explain anything to me because he didn't want to alter my worldview. He didn't feel it was his right to change my religious viewpoint or to change my philosophy or my perception of life. He didn't feel that it was his right to tread on that. You know, he was being respectful of me. And it was only recently, listening to him talk at a standard class, that he reminded me that in the first 5 years of the existence of his school, he was very careful not to tread on people's worldviews and philosophies by teaching them these skills that would take them deeper into their awareness. And so what he would do is simply teach them fox walking and wide-angle vision, and then he would notice that if they practiced that continuously, that they would start to develop these, what we would call higher resources, you know, spiritual resources, instinctive resources, whatever we want to call this, right? So he made that clear to me, that in practicing owl vision and fox walking, that that would be enough all by itself to take me out of a thoughtful space into what we call the sacred silence. And if you continue to practice that, the stillness of mind would go deeper into those brain waves that biofeedback called delta and theta, those really deep brain states, which is what are known as the realm of the shaman, the land of the spirit. These are the deeper mindset states that Stalking Wolf talked about, where powerful healing abilities were rooted, and powerful visioning, seeing into the future, connecting with the dreams, connecting with the ancestors. That's what it's all connected to. So I remember one particular experience that stands out in my mind when I was sleeping in Middletown, New Jersey, in a little farm that the school occupied for a number of years, in a beautiful place surrounded by forests, and there were lots of deer around, and perfect transition areas with creeks flowing through. It was a really great place for bird language. And I was listening in my sleep, you know how you're sort of half awake, half asleep, and you can hear the bird chorus in the morning, and I always like to keep my windows open so I could hear the bird chorus. And in the grayness of dawn, I hear this intense alarming of cardinals. Chip, 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 chip. And they're going crazy. And it causes me to spring up out of my bed. And I dash to the window, and I put my face to the screen, and I'm looking into the, you know, that really impossible light to see, and it's not quite light enough to see. Yet I can still see movement, and I can see the cardinals and the blackberries, and they're having just a general heart attack, you know, and there's a male and a female, and they're focusing on something that I can't see. But I can tell they're both facing in the, at the same point. Something's in between them. And they're making this noise, and they're fluttering around. And all of a sudden, I'm watching for a long time, waiting for something, and I notice a screech owl fly up out of there, land on a branch on a locust tree, right next to the locust tree, and it flies over and lands at a woodpecker hole with a shelf fungus over top of it. It was like a woodpecker hole with a little eave over it, you know, like it had an awning. And it landed and went into that hole and disappeared. And when it flew up to that higher point, the cardinals went from being really intense, chip, 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 to chip, 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 chip. And when it went in the hole, they went chip, chip, chip. And eventually they settled down. It took them about another minute and a half, 2 minutes to finally settle down after having had that experience. What I concluded from that was that those cardinals were probably roosting, right? And it was still dark, and that that owl had made a play for one of them and tried to get one of them while it was on its roost. And at the last minute, you know, death was avoided, but that it created an intense moment for those cardinals. And they were completely freaked out. And that freak out lasted for a while. So after a few weeks passed, I'd been doing some serious tracking in my area around my house. I had found the tracks of several deer, and I was consistently able to find the does and the yearlings. I could get into the forest right near my house, and this was within 15 yards of my house where they were hanging out. You know, kind of reminds me of the leopard story I was telling you before. When I first moved in there, I had no idea there was deer that close to my house every day. But it was right behind that blackberry thicket where that cardinal incident took place, that's where the day beds were. So looking out the window from that height, I could see where the deer were if I could see them. But you can't see them because they get into the shadows and they're really good at hiding. So I began to track those deer, and I started to find the tracks of a buck, an old buck who was walking in that one minus gate that I was describing to you earlier. So that he was one of those mossy backs, I'm sure, who was learning to be a scout himself, who also had a game leg. He had one injured leg. His left rear was injured, probably in being hit by a car or something, and it healed funny so that that deer kind of had a funny limp to it. I started to see these tracks around, and I started to be curious about this deer, and I looked for it and never could find it. And mind you, it wasn't like we had Weyerhaeuser Wilderness next to this place. We had a couple of hundred acres maximum that this deer could squirt into. But it managed to entirely elude me. I could see those does and those yearlings, and I could see another young buck that I saw from time to time, but I could never see this old-timer, right? He just wouldn't let me see him. One morning, it's again pre-dawn, and I have this really intense dream. And in this dream, there's two bucks fighting, the old buck with the game leg and a younger buck, and they're beating their heads into each other, and they're fighting and wrestling and, you know, racking around, and, you know, this battle's going on. And then the scene changes, and about 1 second later in the dream, the young buck is lying dead on the ground. And I have no idea how or why it died, it's just dead. And then that old buck kind of walks away. And in the dream, I swore to you, when I saw that battle going on, it looked like the old buck was finished. Like it looked like this young guy was going to take over. You know, that it looked that grim for the old guy. And then the young buck was lying dead. So then I'm sort of coming out of the dream, and I'm sort of in this kind of drifty, dreamy state, and I hear chip, 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 and I'm like, oh, cool. You know, it's like go right to the screen expecting to have the whole owl story repeat in front of me, right? But there's nothing there. I see the cardinals, and I can see what they're alarming at. They're in a different place this time. They're higher up, and they're in a different position, and the pattern is different. Everything is different, except for the fact that it's cardinals at first light. But there's a different feeling to the scenery this morning. I'm about to go away from the window to go back to sleep again. And something inside of me says, no, wait. So I don't know why, and I wait. And I'm just kind of sitting there, and I'm starting to get, you know, sort of just wanting to go back to sleep again. Right? Starting to get drifty again. Oh, I'll just go back to sleep again. You know, I'll just kind of sleep on the screen. I'll end up with a little pattern of screen on my forehead, you know. But in that kind of dreamy state, all of a sudden I see something moving. I must have been 5 minutes sitting there perfectly still waiting for something to happen. And I see something moving, and from my right, which is where there's a busy highway, from my right, comes this old buck limping across my yard, the very one I just dreamed about. And he goes limping past me under the window, and I'm looking down in total disbelief. The one I just dreamed about is walking by me under my window. So, of course, this thought enters my head, which probably would enter your head too. Where's that young buck, right? But I'm thinking, well, I only have a few minutes. I went and took a shower and looked at the time, had a little breakfast, and it was time to go. So I left, and I didn't think again about it, right? And that day I came home from school. You know, I was teaching at the time. I came home, and I didn't think anything about it because I had done my after-school programs. I was kind of tired, and, you know, I just sort of went in and went about my day. And it was the next day I was out walking around, and I remembered the whole dream sequence, and I remembered that old buck walking through the yard, and I picked up his two-day-old tracks, and I was watching him and looking at him. And I ended up, for some reason, intuitively being drawn behind the blackberry hedge, you know, into the area where the day beds were. And I found the young buck lying dead there. And he had been hit by a car, and he only had enough energy after being hit by the car to get into that thicket and to lie down and die. And that's where the cardinals were alarming, because that young buck had crawled into their roost and laid down and died right there. That's what they were alarming about, right? But it took it 2 days later, and unfortunately, if I had known sooner, I would have been able to at least get something out of that deer, you know, the hide at least, right? But now at this point, it had gone a little bit too far. But I figured it out. I backtracked those two deer, and you know what happened? The old buck was fighting with the young buck across the busy highway, and their scuffle was all around there. And at a certain point, they stopped scuffling there, and the old buck crossed the street, and the young buck followed it. It's almost as if that old buck knew how to cross the street without getting hit, and it used that opportunity to let the young one get hit. And that was a very profoundly powerful lesson for me. Mainly because, as I was telling you earlier, the question that I had in my mind was answered 2 days later, just because I followed my instincts. And the other thing that came from that was about a year and a half or 2 years later, we found the skeleton of that buck. It had gone to sleep with its nose to its tail in a beautiful place in the forest, and its skeleton was still in that sleeping position, and it had a magnificent rack on it. And it as a very old animal, I can't tell you how old it was, its teeth wear was really unbelievable. That thing had been around, and it had seen a lot. But the bone of its back leg, you could see the scar where the bone had healed funny, and the wear on the hoof, because it limped funny, its hip, the hoof worn crooked. And that skull to this day hangs on the wall of my son's bedroom. You know, that deer was a powerful teacher for me. You know, really brought home a lot of these lessons that I'm sharing with you now. So, listening to that, you know, that story, you know, the idea, the connection between developing dreaming abilities or seeing abilities, intuitive abilities, and bird language, you know, the connection is clearly there, and it's tied up in, you know, simply what we've come to know in our school as brain patterning. You know, I don't want to dismiss religious practice or mystical practice as somehow not valuable. I believe it is valuable, in as much as we don't get so caught up in it that it causes us to not like each other because we're practicing different forms of it. You know, and as the elder Dave Bald Eagle told us, he's a Dakota elder from the Dakotas out there near Bear Butte. He said to me, said to all of us on one of our cross-country tours a couple years ago, there's two things I won't talk about with people. One of them is politics, and the other is religion, because those are the two things that cause people to separate from one another. And so I don't want to cause any more separation in my life than already happens by itself in this crazy world we live in. Everything is about separation now. So those are two topics I ask you not to bring up with me, religion and politics. You know, and it's true. You know, religion, especially Native religion, has always been a cultural enhancement to increase the people's awareness so they could live better in their place. And it helped them to develop meditative states so that they could have deeper awareness and stronger instincts and better healing ability and better thinking ability and vision so that they could see into the future and anticipate changes and be better leaders, you know, and all that sort of thing. But where it becomes a sort of a dogmatic approach, and people really get hung up on the details of it, it causes people to not like each other because they develop different brain patterns. They don't recognize each other anymore because they're practicing mental practices that cause us to separate. And that's where the concept in our school of dawa comes in. Dawa is a word that Ingwe brought to us, meaning medicine. And in this case, we're not talking about the American Medical Association definition of medicine, but we're talking about the native definition, spirit medicine, spirit knowledge. The knowledge, for instance, when I talk about cougar medicine, what I'm talking about is the accumulation of all the characteristics, strategies, thought process, wisdom that comes from a cougar who really learns his lessons or her lessons well in the landscape. If you can take all of that knowledge in a pill, you might call that cougar medicine. So the idea of dawa is basically referring to the collection of all the native medicine that can come into a scout who learns these skills, and the effect that it will have on your awareness and on your brain states and your ability to perceive and know beyond the obvious. So that's what we call the Dawa teachings of our school, the Dawa Shield. And bird language is the core of it for us, because I don't like to talk about these spiritual things with people unless they themselves have been going to their secret spot for a couple of years, because at that point they're beginning to develop the same level of an understanding and appreciation of these spiritual things. But as I say, they're not religious things, and they're not mystical. To me, they're just natural. As I say on the bird language tape, Native Eyes number 6, that I don't really like to separate these spiritual things from natural, because Native people didn't have to do that. These quote-unquote spiritual abilities are nothing more than highly evolved instinctive ability that all the animals already possess. But the animals don't start religions based on it. You know, there isn't the denomination of wolf spirit medicine, you know, that then there's the other one over here is the second, you know, wolf medicine church, and they don't do all that stuff. It's just natural. And the thing that's common to all the native people worldwide, which makes a lot of their religious and spiritual views very similar, is that they all raise their children in the way that I describe here. That they raise them to have tremendous awareness, and that's what helps them to evolve a spiritual outlook, a spiritual understanding, spiritual wisdom. So on the other side, we'll kind of wrap this whole thing up, and we'll talk about what we call the seven symptoms of spiritual awareness or evolving the natural mind, the seven symptoms of becoming a natural person. These are all reflections of brain patterning.